All right, let's make this happen.
The 1940s, golden age of radio. Whoa, oh. Turn back that dial and stay for a while. The times are a-changing. A podcast, new sound, taking it back. You hear that? You hear that? We're on a new track.
Hello and welcome again to another episode of the Second Golden Age of Radio. I'm Richard Templeman, and today's special guest is Dan Foreman. Welcome to the show. Have you any experience in the old-time radio universe? If so, tell me more.
Hey, thanks for having me on. My experience with old-time radio is slim to none. I've heard about it. I know it was a big thing back in the day. I know the Lone Ranger was something that was popular, and I know maybe I think War of the Worlds was another thing. And I think it's kind of interesting that one caused a big stir, and people actually were afraid aliens were invading. So I know about that. But no, I think maybe I've heard one in my life a long, long time ago. So yeah, not much experience at all.
Very nice. Yes, the Lone Ranger was an old-time radio show, and we covered a Western the other day on the podcast called Have Gun, Will Travel. Gunsmoke was another radio show that they turned into TV. A lot of them did transfer to TV, depending on how popular they were. So it's interesting that we get to listen to a detective story, like a film noir style, almost. We will be covering a show called The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, which was a radio series featuring Raymond Chandler's private eye, Philip Marlowe. The program differed from most others in its genre. It was a more hard-boiled program than many of the other private detective shows of the time, containing a few quips or quaint characters. There was also another show called The New Adventures of Philip Marlowe. It was a detective drama on NBC or CBS, and it ran from June 17th, 1947 to September 15th, 1958. Notable in the show, there was an episode that aired 11/26/49 called The Birds on the Wing, and it is notable because its beginning and ending both uncharacteristically break the fourth wall. It opens with Marlowe saying he is currently reading Chandler's latest, The Little Sister. Thus, a fictional character claims to be reading an actual book in which he is the main character. Crazy. Even more surreal was the ending, in which Marlowe returns to his apartment to find Gracie Allen, who asks Marlowe to find her husband George Burns, a radio show on which he can sing. Despite the program's popularity, it had no sponsor for most of the time on the air. The lone exceptions were when Ford Motor Company and subsequently Wrigley's Gum sponsored it during part of 1950. The episode we're going to be listening to of The Adventures of Philip Marlowe is Who Shot Waldo? From June 12, 1947. So let's take a listen to it. Then we will summarize it and react to what we thought of it. And then we will come back and make our own version of a Philip Marlowe new time radio show. Yay! BRB. Bring radio back.
Brothers Company presents the Pepsodent program, The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, starring Van Heflin. Pepsodent presents Philip Marlowe, Hollywood's famous private detective created by Raymond Chandler. Philip Marlowe, tough, cynical private eye of Murder My Sweet, the sardonic, case-hardened detective of The Brasher Doubloon, The Lady in the Lake, and The Big Sleep. You've seen him in action in all of those top-flight mystery pictures. Now, in order that you may continue to enjoy this exciting mystery series, Pepsodent brings you The Adventures of Philip Marlowe on the air with a cast of noted radio players and starring MGM's brilliant and dynamic young actor, Van Heflin.
Rough desert wind blowing into Los Angeles that evening. It was one of those hot, dry Santa Anas that come down through the mountain passes and curl your hair, make your nerves jump and your skin itch. On nights like that, every booze party ends up in a fight, and meek little housewives feel the edge of a carving knife and study their husbands' necks. Anything can happen when a Santa Ana blows in from the desert. I closed up my office early. I got tired of reading Philip Marlowe, private investigator, backwards on the ground glass of my office door. So I opened the door and closed it from the outside and locked it and went out to get a beer before I went up to my apartment.
Fill her up again, Mr. Marlon?
Marlowe. Marlon is a fish.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, you bartender. Come in on a ride.
That drunk again. What'd you expect in this business? Autograph hunts?
Make it snappy, yeah?
Be right with you, sport. I gotta draw this man a beer.
Well, Mr. Marlowe, anything new?
Yes. The police found some pearls in Waldo's car.
They found my pearls?
No, not exactly.
Not exactly.
Well, Waldo was getting set to jip you, Lola. He had the diamond clasp of your necklace attached to a string of cheap imitations. And then he sold the real pearls.
Oh, how... Oh.
These are the imitations, yeah.
Yes. But it is my clasp. The clasp is real.
Is that all right?
Yes, it's the clasp that Jenny Domus gave me. Of course it's all right.
Oh, that's swell.
Thank you so much, Mr. Marlowe.
Forget it.
I won't. Not ever. But is this goodbye?
Yeah, I think so. You'll never get over Johnny Domus, will you? If anybody ever bothers you again, though, well, let me know. Name's Philip Marlowe. I drove almost to Malibu and then I parked and looked out on the rock cliff. Then I reached in my pocket and dug out the string of Bohemian glass pearls that Lieutenant Ibarra found in Waldo's car. I cut the knot at one end and slipped the pearls off one by one. One by one, I flipped them into the water. The gull swooped down on them and they flapped up again, screaming indignantly. The phony pearls had fooled Waldo and Lola Barsley, but they couldn't fool a seagull. I said to myself, to the memory of Johnny Dalmas, just another four-flusher. I listened a while to the wheeling seagulls. All at once, I realized that the wind had died. The Santa Ana had blown itself out. The red wind was done. It was over.
So, welcome back. Just listen to the episode, Who Shot Waldo? I believe that's what it's called. I listened to the whole episode and I was so confused. But because it was based on the short story called Red Wind by Raymond Chandler in 1938, I read a synopsis of that and that helped me understand the episode a lot better. A man walks into a bar and asks the bartender, "Seen a lady in here? Tall, pretty brown hair and a print bolero jacket over a blue silk crepe dress, wearing a wide-brimmed straw hat with a velvet band?" And then the man who's drunk whips out a .22 and shoots the man twice. "So long, Waldo." So we don't know what's going on. Then Marlowe goes back to his apartment and the elevator door opens and he sees a girl dressed just as Waldo had described. He suggests she slip out of that jacket and hat, because people are looking for her. Then, while they are talking, Marlowe hears the elevator and footsteps, and the man who killed Waldo points the same .22 in Marlowe's face, and the dame comes up and pokes the gun into his ribs and saves his life. She leaves, Marlowe calls the cops, etc., etc. Later, the dame reconnects with Marlowe, spills names like a third hot toddy. She is Lola, wife of Frank Barsley. She gives Marlowe her address. and that weird old-timey thing where she gives the last five digits of her phone number. Frank was out of town, so she started keeping time with Stan Phillips for polishing his fob. He gave her a pearl necklace worth $15,000, although it felt like $1 million. After Stan died in a plane crash, she hooked up with the chauffeur, Waldo. So there's where Waldo comes in. Then Frank returned, booted Waldo out, but Waldo stole the necklace and held it hostage for a lower price of $5,000. Lola asks Marlo to search Waldo's apartment because that necklace has sentimental value. He doesn't find the necklace, but he does find a dead man. So we continue on. Basically, they finally go and search another place and find the police in conjunction with Marlo. They kind of solve the mystery of who shot Waldo. Perfect. Then they recovered out of Waldo's car the pearl necklace, and they were like $100 necklace, so fake pearls, and she never knew. So Lola says sadly her and Frank are separating. Marlo switched the fake pearls with even faker pearls and said, well, it has the diamond necklace part that is from your necklace, but he must have taken the original expensive pearls and replaced it for these fakes. And she's like, well, thank you, Philip Marlowe. Okay, and so I didn't get the ending either, so someone explained it a little bit more, that the pearls were always fake, so as not to disappoint Lola, who was genuinely in love with this Stan, Marlowe has a second set of more obvious fakes made up and tells her that Waldo must have fenced the originals. Then she could have the sentimental value of the necklace. Ta-da! It was a long plot, and I had to go over it that way in my head because I didn't get it on my first listen. But it was the first pilot episode, so I can see why it was a little hard to listen to. One of the things notable to me in the script was how they described people's appearances to a T. It was almost too much. And then another favorite line of mine was, he's dead. So I like how many times he said the word dead.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think I always have had trouble with film noir, even when I'm watching it, because like you were saying, I think the plots are really convoluted, and there's something about the rhythm of it that kind of lulls me to sleep a little bit. But I do admire kind of how all of these different characters and all these different threads are sort of like tied up at the end, which is kind of interesting. They also have this like creepiness about them that kind of makes my skin crawl a little bit. Yeah, and this one did that for me.
Yeah, I can see that. A little bit overkill on the plot and different connections. So it's cool that it does all connect at the end, but there's some creepiness to it. And like I said, there was a lot of descriptors like, this dame walked in and she had this outfit on and she looked this way, brown hair, blue eyes, just describing what everything looks like. I was a little intimidated, but like I said as well, just reading the summary of the story helped me comprehend it a little bit easier. So yeah, it was interesting, and it's definitely not my favorite style of old-time radio show, but I do like mysteries in general, so detective stories can be interesting, but they can also be a little weird and convoluted.
Yeah, I think my favorite descriptor in the story was in the very beginning, actually, with the Santa Ana wind coming in through the desert, and that setting the scene. I guess they were in L.A., and how the narrator, it gave him like a weird feeling about things, just that wind and that spooky wind throughout the desert, and I think that's a cool way to set the scene.
Yeah, obviously the writing from the source material of Raymond Chandler, he's very good, and that was a good mental image of how to start the story. Agreed. It was good.
Yeah, I have a question for you, Richard. Did you care that much about the woman who was like in trouble? Because that's another thing I kind of like. I didn't really feel like I cared about her plight or anyone's plight. I didn't really feel that emotionally engaged or connected to what she was going through. And I think that's sort of like because of the way that they talk is kind of flat and quick. And doesn't connect.
Oh, good question. I also felt like I didn't much care for the protagonist. I mean, the detective is a protagonist, but who he was helping is also a protagonist. The dame, as we refer to her, she kind of was unsympathetic because she's like, I cheated on my husband with Stan and with Waldo. And, you know, my husband Frank isn't going to leave me by the end of the story because I'm also unsympathetic to the characters in the story. So, yeah, it was funny, like, the trope is to have, like, this beautiful woman that you're helping, but usually I feel like she's innocent, or if she's naughty, it's more, like, implied. But this one, she was basically like, I'm a sinner, and I cheat with people, but you still gotta help me find my pearls that are fake. Yeah, that's funny.
I completely missed the, when you were doing the synopsis, just recapping the synopsis, I didn't realize they were fake to begin with, and that Marlo was just creating a story to make her feel better. I totally missed that part of it.
I did too, and so that's why I had to find a synopsis where I could read what happened, because I do not think in this version of the script it was clear what he was doing. I was like, why is he throwing her pearls into the ocean? Like, aren't they her pearls? And then he's like, fake pearls, fake pearls. And I'm like, yeah, you made them fake, but they were fake to begin with. Then he was getting rid of the original fakes, and he gave her more fakes so she would think, oh, I used to have the expensive diamond, or the expensive pearls on my diamond necklace, and now they're fake, but the sentimental value can still be there. Yeah, I was confused, so I looked it up. So that was not clear in the original broadcast of this episode.
Another thing I was confused about was the suitcase. Like, what was in it? They said, like, bills were in it, and I guess that was used to blackmail the husband, but I didn't know, I didn't get what bills meant.
Good question. The only thing I can see in here, because that confused me too, the only part I can read in the synopsis that might become a little clear is when Frank returned, he kicked out Waldo. Waldo stole the necklace, held it hostage, so maybe the money was from the husband, part of the hostage money in the briefcase. He doesn't find the necklace. Yeah, that's all I can think that it was part of it. It's also interesting that this same script was like the pilot for the radio show. It was written in the magazine already, in the Dime Detective. Then they created two television versions of it, one with Powers Booth and the other with Danny Glover as Marlo. Had no idea about that. And they both tried to copy the performances of Humphrey Bogart when he played Philip Marlowe in the films. So this story has been done several times, and I guess it gets more and less convoluted with each version. In fact, they said there was an interesting theory about the second set of pearls in one of the episodes, and it doesn't really fit with the short story. So I'd be interested to hear what the other theory is of the pearls, but I'm probably not going to go into the weeds to research that much, but food for thought. It must be a good enough story that they redid it a lot of times.
Yeah, I think I'd rather read this kind of thing than listen to it, just because a lot of the dialogue is garbled, and if I can read it, I can process it better. Interesting to see a film version or a television version of that. I, again, Yeah, I mean, I'm not... I'm not really into, like, older things in general, like, older movies, and I kind of, like, tend to zone out because it just looks... It looks fake. It looks, like, the black and white is distracting, and it doesn't look genuine to me. So, this is the kind of thing I would rather read, I think, because all the sounds and the visuals get are just distracting to me.
Well, that's kind of a good segue for what I like to do in the third part of the podcast. If we were to make our own new version of this radio drama, so it would still be an audio format, but it can be brought into the 21st century, how would we go about it? Like, a detective nowadays has the internet, has smartphones, the 21st century. How would we go about it? Like, a detective nowadays has the internet, has smartphones, GPS, lots of different helpful tools for the gumshoe, if you will. So this would be an interesting tale to tell in today's society.
Hey, I'm a detective, and my name is Phil Marr, and I was minding my own business when I got a phone call on my cell from a possible client. I answered, said, "Hey, it's Phil Marr, detective. How can I help you?"
"Yes, hello. Hello, Phil. The name's David. David Applegate. And I have a terrible emergency to report. My wife has been murdered. Your reputation precedes you. You are the best. You're the best private eye in this city, in this lonely city. And I don't know what happened. I'm just completely out of sorts."
"Well, Mr. Applegate, maybe you're into something shady. I'm not sure why you wouldn't call the police. Was your wife into something shady?"
"My wife, you know, I didn't really know what she was up to. She was a dancer, you know. She was an entertainer. She took people around town. I didn't always know where she was at. She'd be gone for days. But I think that's why she loved me. I gave her freedom to express herself."
"I believe that line of work is called being an escort."
Sure, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't around. Look, that's besides the point. I went into my apartment last night, not expecting to see her because she's usually out late, and she was there on the floor. She was shot."
"Mr. Applegate, could you text me some pictures? And perhaps text me your address so I can go over there?"
Sure. Okay, I'm texting now. Oh, God. Okay, sent. How soon can you arrive? I mean, I kind of wrapped her body and I didn't know what to do. I don't know what she's been up to. I didn't want to call the police, and she's still in my apartment. How soon can you come over?"
"I'm on my way right now. It'd probably take me 5-10 minutes. Not that far. Don't go anywhere."
We cut to Mr. Applegate's apartment. He's there by himself. He lives in a one-bedroom apartment. It's very old, pre-war, in a very dangerous, shady neighborhood. And he's sitting in the kitchen with a... on his phone, looking at news, the latest news, and trying to distract himself.
"Now, from the looks of everything that I'm seeing, sir, Mr. Applegate, the police are going to think it's you, because it's like you tried to hide the evidence that your wife was even murdered. You started to wrap her up. Seems like they always go to the husband first. So if I'm going to help you solve this, we really can't get the police involved at this point because you'll be sentenced to life in prison just from this circumstantial evidence.
No, no, it wasn't me. Please, you have to believe me. Look, the reason I didn't go to the police is because she's involved in an illegal trade, like you said. She's an escort, but the laws here haven't quite passed to allow her to do all of the various activities that she does with other men and women. And she's kind of supporting us right now. And I just don't want the police nosing around.
Well, I'm gonna need a list of the people that she's been dealing with. Otherwise, I will have no suspects to go on.
People she's been dealing with, huh? Well, geez, I mean, I see one or two of the people she's been dealing with. She sees this one lady a lot. I believe, I don't know exactly what she does. She's an Uber driver, and she's also a Lyft driver, and I think she's also a taxi driver. But my wife meets her frequently at this hookah place down the street, and they spend a lot of time together. Her name is Madison, or something like, yeah, Madison Story.
Well, I'll start there. I'll talk to this Madison Story. And just so you know, I also don't follow the law, if you know what I mean. I'm a legitimate private investigator, but I can be known to do some shady things, so I'll make sure to bring some weapons just in case I should try to, or someone should try to kill me. I went immediately over to the hookah bar that Mr. Applegate spoke of, and no sooner had I arrived than I was scouting the door to see who would come in when I saw a lady with short, black hair, sunglasses that she took off to reveal green eyes, with a name tag that said Madison. I knew I had her. So I went for her to sit down, and I moved tables over to where she was sitting. I said, "Well, well, well, Miss Story, have you got a tale to tell?"
Who are you? Who are you? I don't know you. Are you a customer? Do you wanna take a few puffs? We got a great selection here, but I don't have any stories to tell strangers. Sorry.
Well, does the name Applegate ring any bells, Miss Story?
Do I know you? I mean, I may or may not know an Applegate, but that's none of your business. I mean, unless did something happen to this person, or who?
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I keeping you from many messages I hear that are coming in?
Who wants to know?
Well, if you are suggesting that something happened to her, you must know more than you're letting on. Because what if I told you she's turned up, stiff as a board, on the floor of her apartment? Does that make your tune change? Are you gonna change your tale now?
God, she's dead? I knew an Applegate. I knew an Applegate. Marianne, yeah, that's Marianne Applegate. She's dead. What happened?
That's what we'd like to know. Somehow, a bullet in the brain seems to have ended her life, if you don't mind me cutting to the chase of it all. And if it's not your gun, then you must know somebody who has one that may have done this to poor Marianne Applegate.
Okay, look, I can't talk here. Let's meet at the Chipotle across the street in 5 minutes.
Five minutes later, I walked into the Chipotle, and no sooner had I sat down at a table when someone walked in with a similar description to the lady I'd just been talking to, but this time the hair was blue, the sunglasses were red, the hat was black, and yet she went straight for my table. Even though she looked completely different.
and started talking to me in a quiet voice.
So listen, I knew Marianne Applegate. She was a friend. I picked her up once when I was driving an Uber. We got to know each other quite well, and I got to learn she was in the business, you know, in the escort business. And you know, I'm a widow, and I was lonely, so we started to hang out for a little bit. She gave me a discount because I couldn't afford her rates, and we would do things together, and we would go to the park, and we would go to the museum, and we would take flights to different places around the country, and she would take me places, and I fell in love with her.
So far, I'm not getting any information that would say that you didn't have a motive to perhaps try to go to her apartment and kill her loving husband and maybe shot her by mistake. You see, I'm connecting dots. I'm pretty good.
No, you don't understand. We were in love. I would never hurt her. Never.
Not on purpose. But perhaps it was an accident. Or perhaps you sent someone nefarious over with a gun to kill Mr. Applegate. And Mrs. Applegate got in the way. And poor Marianne is dead. Either way, if you're not fully responsible, I believe you're half responsible. Tell me it ain't so.
You don't know the full story. You don't know what I know. Mr. Applegate, he was a horrible man. He was terrible. He was gonna turn Marianne in. He was gonna turn her into he was gonna cut off her business and sell her to this other man for money. He was involved. It was a payoff. It was a payoff. He was gonna ruin her.
Well, look. I'm not saying that what you did was right. But the only way I see for you to get out of this without going to jail, or even to stay alive and get through this, I'm gonna have to concoct a plan with you, because I like you. If you haven't figured it out already, I'm starting to fall in love with you. And I know it's abrupt, and I know it's coming out of nowhere, but I feel bad for you. And I know your heart was for Marianne, but if your heart could be even a little bit for me, I want to protect you. So what I'm going to have to do is you're going to have to meet me at this address that I'm texting to you now. We're going to put a little makeup on you. It's going to make it look like I've gone ahead and ended you. But it's actually just your new beginning. Once I take pictures with my iPhone, I can bring them over to Mr. Applegate, and he'll assume that I've taken you out as per justice would require, but I would rather take you out because I love you. What do you say?
I don't even know your name.
I'm sorry, but are names important here? The name is Mar. Phil Mar. I'm a private D, but I would like to be your private D.
Oh God, haven't you been listening? I'm into women. I'm a lesbian.
I thought your heart could go both ways, and now my heart that was going one way is starting to break. Listen, we need to make up some compromise here, because if I don't kill you, Mr. Applegate might seek revenge on you and you die. Do you see my dilemma?
I swear to you, I did not kill her. I did not kill her. I did not like her husband. Her husband was an evil man trying to blackmail her. He was gonna get a lot of money to turn her in. But I did not kill her. I was in love with her. You must help me find who killed her.
Well, this plot is thickening. Look, did you tell anybody? Like, think real hard. Did you tell anybody about Mr. Applegate's feelings of maybe wanting to turn his wife in? Or maybe your affair with Mrs. Applegate? Did you tell a single soul? Because that would narrow it down.
Yes, I told Marty. I told Marty at the drugstore to get my I buy my cigarettes from him. We're good friends, but Marty wouldn't say anything.
I'm afraid he didn't say anything. I'm afraid he might have used a bullet to send a message. And if my suspicions are correct, I'm gonna need to pay Marty a visit. But first I'm gonna Facebook message him.
What's this? Who's this, Facebook Messenger? I didn't even know I had this app. Who's Philip Marr? Who is this?
Dear Marty, I was referred to you by my friend, Miss Story. She recommended I buy cigarettes from you. Can we meet at your drugstore that you work at or somewhere? I just want to get to know you. Miss Story says nice things about you.
All right. Well, any friend of Madison is a friend of mine. Yeah. Sure. Let's meet at the store. Let's meet at the Walgreens at Fourth and Pike. 10 minutes.
Ten minutes later, I arrived. At the Walgreens on 4th and Pike, and I saw a man about 5'3", stocky but strong looking, had a name tag on that said Marty. Figured that was the guy I was looking for. I introduced myself. Hi, it's Phil Marr from Facebook. I know Madison.
Yes. All right. Come back. Come into the back, into my office, and we'll talk there. We cut into this in the small office in the back of the Walgreens. There's a small TV that's just on, but it's static. There's like posters of NBA basketball players. And there's a little snow globe on a small wooden desk with a bunch of papers strewn across.
Well, this office looks very interesting. Very interesting indeed, Marty.
Thank you. So anyway, have a seat. Is something happened to Madison? She comes in every day to get her e-cigarettes, and I always tell her, you know, these aren't healthy. There's a chemical. They just found out there's a chemical that will give you health problems. So I always told her to stop it, but she wouldn't listen to me. But I loved her. She was like a daughter to me.
A protective gene in you. Toward Madison, Well, I'll tell you one thing. She was running around with someone who's no longer running around, if you know what I mean.
Wait. This doesn't have to do with that Marianne Applegate, does it? I never trusted her. Not for one second.
Which sounds like you had motive to get rid of her. Yes, to answer your question, yes, this has a lot to do with Marianne Applegate. That's the only reason I've been hopping around town all day, trying to figure things out. And something tells me that you know more than you're telling me.
That Marianne Applegate, she was a bad influence on Madison. She, they would go places and they would gamble and they would smoke and they would drink and they would just have these wild parties, secret parties, all night long, and Madison would always come in every morning to buy her cigarettes, and she would always seem disturbed and sickened, and she never looked well, and she looked like she was unraveling, and it was all because of that Applegate was wearing her thin. It was not a sustainable situation.
So you figured it was either Marianne or Madison. One of them had to go, and I can see you're very partial to Miss Madison's story, and you couldn't give two craps about Marianne Applegate, so I assume you took care of her?
No, I didn't kill her. I didn't do anything. I'm not a killer. I swear I'm not a killer. There's something else that you don't know. It's about her husband, David.
I'm listening. David, who took care of Marianne Applegate, but can no longer take care of her because she's been taken care of. Go on.
This is hard to say, but, okay, I'm in love with David Applegate. We've been having an affair. We've been lovers for a long time, and he told me some things. He told me some things about Marianne that, you know, he wanted her to stop this life. He wanted her to stop, and he didn't know how to do it.
Someone tells me that you knew how to do it. And if you didn't tell him, then you either told yourself or someone else who did do it.
I told him, all right, I told him to go to the police. I told him to go to the police and strike a deal, an underhanded deal with them for money in exchange for turning Marianne in. I gave him the idea, all right?
So how does she end up dead on the floor if this was a scheme that was supposed to put her in jail?
Look, I think things went south with the agent. That's all I can say. His name is Agent Gustafson. That was the policeman that Applegate was dealing with, and I think they had a secret meeting at his apartment. I heard something went down, but that's all I can say.
Well, I think I have some ideas of what went on. I have one more plan, one more scheme up my sleeve. I'm going to clone David's number so it'll look like I'm David, and I'm gonna text Officer Gustav. Is that what you said?
Gustafson.
I'm going to text this Officer Gustafson, and I'll appear to be David. Then I'll have Gustafson's number, and I'll use that to text David. Then we're all gonna meet together in one room, the room where it happened, the room where I don't know what went down, but I know that their scheme together probably ended Marianne's life for good. And if I could get them in the room together, and if I'm hiding in the bathroom, I think I'm gonna hear what happened. Don't worry. I'll have my weapons with me. I have a Colt 45, and then I have other weapons that are, like, more new than that.
All right, we cut to Applegate's apartment. Gustafson bursts in. He kicks down the door. Applegate! What's going on? Why'd you want to see me? Does this have to do with you know, Marianne?
I'm in the bathroom, in the closet, in the bathroom, listening to this. I'm excited. Looks like either Applegate's gonna spill the beans or Gustafson's gonna spill the beans. But I think my plan's working.
Applegate is just on his bed reading the newest science fiction novel from Robert Jordan. He springs up from his bed. Gustafson, what are you doing here? Why did you just kick down my door? What, Marianne? What, What's going on? You know very well what's happening with Marianne. What are you doing here? What? You texted me. Damn it. Come on, I'm busy. What's this about? God damn it, Gustafson. I did not text you. Look, Marianne's body is in the closet right now. Okay? After the gun went off, after you shot her, you just kind of left me hanging here. I didn't know what to do with the body, all right? This is... I got this private detective. I think he's on the trail, but I tried to distract him. I don't know what's happening.
Ooh, looks like I almost have the full story. I'm gonna stay in this closet that's in the bathroom for just another few seconds.
Damn it, Applegate! Private detective! Why did you call a private detective?
That's right. Why did he call me? Why did he call a private detective?
Oh, God damn it, Gustafson. I was trying to pin it on him. I was trying to frame him. I knew if he met Madison, Madison would plant the gun on him.
What the? Oh my gosh. How couldn't I not see this in my suit jacket pocket? There is a pocket-sized gun. And this bullet that goes in this gun is about the same size as the bullet we found in Marianne's head. Oh, so the sting that has been planned was against me this whole time. They all conspired. Everybody I met today was in on it. I guess Marty, though, couldn't have been. Otherwise, he would have warned Gustafson and Applegate. Oh, geez. I'm gonna text Marty and have him bring a video camera over and maybe a separate weapon. Hopefully he gets here soon, because I'm gonna plan on coming out of my hiding spot in just one more second.
What? You're trying to frame the private detective? How are you gonna go about doing that? God damn it, Gustafson. Don't you get it? He's in the bathroom right now. I had Marty call the police. They should be here in 2 seconds. They're gonna catch him with a gun, and we'll be free as birds.
Holy crap. I am going to go down for murder, and they know I'm in the bathroom closet. All right, I have one Hail Mary left. And since Marty's also in on it, and Madison's in on it, and now Gustafson's in on it, and Applegate was always in on it, the only Hail Mary I have left is to throw you, Marianne, throw you into the line of fire. So I know you're stiff as a board and dead as a doornail, but on the count of three, I'm gonna use you as a human shield. Sorry about this, Mrs. Applegate. One, two, three. Boom, break out of the door, holding the body. You guys may be clever, but I bet you didn't think that I would be using a dead body in such a way. I start kind of throwing the dead body around, but keeping a hold on it so it's guarding me in case they should shoot. Hopefully it would hit Marianne and not me. I smack Mr. Applegate over the head. I smack Gustafson in the shin. And I'm working my way out of the door.
A chase ensues. Gustafson and Applegate pursue the private eye, but not before taking out their guns, their revolvers, and their shotguns, and their lasers. Yes, lasers from the closets, pursuing the detective, Philip Marr, running down the street, the three of them, shooting.
Well, I'm glad I took my workout classes this month. This is exhilarating in a very bad way. Oh my goodness. Just then, I noticed the police are coming. The police are coming and they're not worried about me with a dead body in my hand. They're worried about lasers and shotguns and pistols that are being fired at me. Oh, thank everything. Thank heavens. Maybe the police will understand what's going on.
All right, all three of you, stop right there. Freeze. Put down the lasers. Put down the body. Put down the shotgun. All of you. All right. Wait, why do you have that dead body? You're Philip Marr, the private detective. What are you doing? You're under arrest.
Wow. Don't arrest the people with the guns. Arrest the people with the dead body, officer. Are you kidding me? Can't you see this is all a scheme against me? If you check my cell phone, you can see all the texting records and phone calls that I've been getting the past couple of days. In fact, why would they be going after me like this if it wasn't them who was trying to frame me? Please look into your heart and your brain, as big or as small as it might be, and try to see that I'm telling the truth.
Just then, an envelope falls out of Gustafson's pocket, and cash spills out of it with a letter. The police officer picks it up. Reads the note. It says that Gustafson was going to pay Applegate to turn in Marianne Applegate for all of her crimes.
Well, see, officer, that note couldn't have fallen from the sky at the most perfect time. So you see, Gustafson wanted to get Marianne in jail, and the deed was going to go down, but somehow a gun was fired and Marianne was dead, and they had to cover it up, so they were going to use me because they know I'm besides the law. I'm not a part of the law. And if you want any more proof, I have a couple more people that are in this scheme that are not running around town. But their names are Madison Story and Marty Gorey. These are the people. And you know, you can't arrest Marianne. She's already dead, but she was a bad guy too.
Gustafson, how could you do this? You swore an oath. You swore an oath to protect this city. What are you doing shady back deals for? God damn. God damn it, man. What is this city coming to? What is this country coming to? Can't even trust the police. It all starts with the president and trickles down. No, the law isn't the law anymore. Right is wrong and wrong is right. My God, man. Look at yourself in the mirror. What have you become? What have we all become?
I guess when a good cop goes bad, and a bad cop's now good, everything's a circle. Everything is topsy-turvy. And I know I'm just a lowly private detective, but if you want, here's my card, officer. You can use me for a future case, since you can't even trust your co-workers anymore. I'll stay on them. I'll stay on everybody. I'll make sure that crime doesn't pay anymore. And even though I let my heart get in the way earlier today, I won't do it again.
Marr, you're the only person I can trust in this town. This will be the start of a very long and productive partnership. Things are gonna change from here on out.
Therefore, that did start the long and adventurous career that Philip Marr, who perhaps was not as successful as a private detective, but as a contracted detective for the police force, well,
He could start changing the city little by little, and hopefully the changes would go up to the whole country. But you'll have to find out next episode of Detective Philip Marr, now that he has got his connections in the police force, but is still able to be his own agent. This is going to be a fruitful relationship indeed. Thanks for tuning in.
Yay, that was fantastic. That concludes our episode of Second Golden Age of Radio. I'd like to thank once again Dan Foreman for lending not only one of his voices, but several of his voices to the podcast. That was so fun. He actually led me on an improvised adventure. I had no idea if any of the suspects that Detective Phil Marr were interviewing, if they were guilty or innocent, and looks like, turns out every single person was guilty. And I love it. What an ending. Tune in next time, now that we're finished with our detective highlight. After four episodes of detective work, we need to move on to a different genre. On Second Golden Age of Radio! Thank you.